take great pleasure in presenting your Master of Ceremonies for this evening, the Honorable Sean O'Keefe, Chairman of the Board of the National Defense Industrial Association and CEO Chairman of EADS North America. Sean.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Please take your seats. Welcome to the 16th NDIA Annual Awards Dinner. Having just asked you to take your seats, now I see on the program, please rise for the presentation of the colors. The Joint Forces Armed Forces Color Guard and remain standing for the national anthem. My apologies. Thank you to the Joint Forces Armed Forces Color Guard. Thank you all. Chaplain Major General Donald L. Rutherford, the Army's Chief of Chaplains, will offer the invocation.
And may we all pray together. Almighty God, we stand here this evening. We pause to acknowledge your presence, to seek your blessings upon our nation, those committed to our national defense, and this gathered assembly. As we honor Secretary Carter, a man trusted with responsibility and endowed with conscience, we pray that you would inspire our service, saving us from goals which may be too easy. May keep us always sensitive to your demands that we may press toward those things which make for peace and bring about dignity to the whole human family. In times like these, when we are permitted to use good grow from our efforts, you help us to discover our own best selves. Lord God, bless this food which you have given to us. Help us to receive it with grateful hearts. And as you nourish our bodies, you strengthen our faith, increase our love, and cause us to grow in service all of our days. This we ask and pray in your holy name. Amen.
Thank you, Chaplain Rutherford. Please take your seats now. Let me, we're departing from the usual practice, folks. Thank you. Departing from the usual tradition of hearing our speaker after dinner, we are going to accelerate the program and ask that you all begin your salads as I introduce our honoree for this evening. This year, our board of directors, selected for the Eisenhower Award, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. This year, our board of directors selected for the Eisenhower Award a distinguished American who clearly carries on General Eisenhower's ideal of responsibly working, a relationship between the government industry and matters related to national defense. This year's honoree is the Honorable Ashton B. Carter, the United States Deputy Secretary of Defense, recognized for his distinguished contributions to national security, his tireless work on behalf of our nation's armed forces, and his supportive working relationship with the U.S. defense industry. Now, Churchill is famously quoted as having said at one point, "We've run out of money, now it's time we have to think." Well, fortunately, we have a gentleman in leadership who always thinks, regardless of whether there's a lot of money or not. And fortunately, in these times, the best we have, the most we have, and absolutely the thing we rely on most is the fact that he does think in the midst of these environments. Since assuming his capacity as Deputy Secretary, Dr. Carter has guided the Defense Department through a period marked by ongoing combat operations in Afghanistan and around the world, shifting strategic priorities, and unprecedented budget uncertainty. Dr. Carter led the development and implementation of a revised defense strategy to sustain the global leadership of the United States into the 21st century. A strategist skill set that he developed much earlier in a post as the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy. He guided the department's efforts to complete the final drawdown of forces in Iraq and began a responsible drawdown from Afghanistan, all while ensuring that our nation's wounded warriors and their families receive the care and support they deserve. He and his wife, Stephanie, are frequent visitors to Walter Reed to verify this firsthand. In his previous role as Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology and Logistics, Dr. Carter ensured the timely delivery of rapid capabilities to combat theaters in fulfillment of combatant commander urgent operational needs, an effort he has continued certainly as Deputy Secretary. But in addition, Dr. Carter crafted, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. In addition, Dr. Carter has crafted a strategy to deliver better value to the taxpayer and for our men and women in uniform by improving the way the department conducts business. In his memorandum, Better Buying Power, he opened an important dialogue for how the department, working with industry, could increase efficiency and productivity in defense spending in response to today's fiscal challenges. Now, beyond these remarkable talents and accomplishments, he's a physicist, a medieval historian, a Rhodes Scholar, and a very trusted colleague among those by both sides of the aisle who were in leadership capacities, a remarkable position in which he is a credible force for representing today's national security policy. For his longstanding commitment to a capable and well-equipped military, his promotion of a strong and vibrant United States defense industrial base, and his steadfast service to our country, the National Defense Industrial Association proudly presents the 2013 Eisenhower Award to the Honorable Ashton B. Carter.
Thanks very much, Sean. Hey, look, Sean told me I was going to have this honor, I said, feed everyone. So, because I went to an NDU dinner a couple of months ago, and Henry Kissinger was one of the guests also, and finally, and we went on and on and on and on and on, and they didn't give us anything to eat. We were all wilting, and Kissinger, and I spoke, and Brent Scowcroft spoke, and then Stephanie and I left, actually. And Kissinger, I understand, finally got up later in the evening and said, well, I thought I might be the breakfast speaker. So I'm not going to do that to you. And so I do encourage you to eat. Please go ahead. Don't worry at all. I will be brief. Let me, first of all, thank and honor and Sean O'Keefe. Sean's been a public servant and in the government and a public servant through his service to our industry for decades now. I've admired him. I admired him when he first served in government. He probably didn't know that, but I knew who he was. And we have a special gift because Sean is with us. And for those of you who know his story, he came close in a plane crash to not being with us, and I remember that time, and I remember his recovery, and wishing him strength in his recovery, and he got strength. And so, Sean, thank you very much for being here. And Congressman Moran, who's kind of a hero of mine, you know, you read these editorials and so forth about how there's nobody in Congress anymore who understands defense or cares or anything like that. It's just not true. And witness, Congressman Moran. Thank you, sir. Thank you for being here. And Larry Farrell, and Arnold Panaro, Dave Melcher, old friend of mine, all the members of NDIA's Executive Committee, Board of Directors, trustees, thank you all for this honor. Sean's right, I got into this business through physics. That's how I started. Everybody has to start somewhere. And I started in physics because I thought that, found that having a technical background allowed me to make a contribution, and that became my way of contributing to our national defense. And now, years later, I remember that. And so to everybody here who is starting out, and there are a few people on my staff who are starting out in their careers, thanks for working in defense, and I hope you make it your career also. It's a great privilege for me to join other recipients of this award, patriots like Bill Perry, who is one of my lifelong mentors. Late Senator Danny Inouye, I was at his funeral just a few months ago. Congressman Ike Skelton, and last year's awardee, our chairman, Buck McKeon, all recipients of the Eisenhower Award. To those of you from our industry, let me just start the evening by saying thank you. Thank you for what you do for us. We don't take it for granted. And I'd ask you to go home tonight and tell your kids or your spouse or whatever that you were thanked because of what you do for national defense. We tend to thank the troops, I understand that second only to the quality of our men and women in uniform, what makes our nation's military the best in the world is the quality of our defense industry, and that's you. So thank you. Your success, your technological vibrancy, your financial success is in the national interest. The long-term interests of the defense industry and the long-term interests of the department are aligned as we work together in defense of the nation. Many of you know in this room, surely, that President Eisenhower, his most famous quote is drawn from his farewell address, where he warned of the dangers of an outsized, what he called, military-industrial complex. And while this is memorable, this quote has been reduced to something of an absurdity, because Eisenhower was, of course, one of our nation's most accomplished generals and the man responsible for the Allied victory in Europe some 15 years before he gave that speech. He clearly understood the vital role played by the defense industry in securing our nation's defense. The larger point of his farewell address was that the interests of the country are served when leaders take the long view, properly align ends with means, and seek what's in the national interest rather than what's in the special interest of some. Eisenhower captured each of these thoughts when he spoke of the need to maintain, and these are his words, balance between the private and the public economy. Balance between cost and hoped for advantages. Balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable. Balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between the actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. He went on to say, maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow, end quote. And that's what I'd like to speak with you about tonight. How the Department of Defense is taking the long view, and how we're differentiating between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable in a time of unprecedented strategic change and financial turbulence. And taking that long view begins with an understanding that we're operating at the convergence of two great historical trends. First, as the President Obama made clear in his new defense strategy, we're turning a strategic corner from the post-9/11 era dominated by two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, to the challenges and opportunities that will define our future. We know that what many of these challenges are: continued turmoil in the Middle East, the persistent threat of terrorism, enduring threats like weapons of mass destruction, and a range of new threats like cyber. We also see great opportunities, among them to shift the great weight of the Department of Defense, both intellectual and physical, that has been devoted to Iraq and Afghanistan, to the Asia-Pacific region, where America's future, in many respects, will lie, and where America will continue and must continue to play its seven-decade-old pivotal stabilizing role into the future. To develop innovative new capabilities from a vibrant technology effort, to capitalize on the lessons of the last decade on how to use forces innovatively, including special forces and the integration of operations and intelligence, to manage presence in new ways, to leverage the reserve and guard components that have performed so superbly over the last decade, and to build the capacity of partners and allies so they can shoulder more of the burden. So as we draw down from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, our force needs to make a very difficult transition from a large, rotational, counterinsurgency-based force to a leaner, more agile, more flexible, and ready force for the future. And that's not to say there's anything wrong with the force we built for Iraq and Afghanistan. It was the right force for the period. And by the way, that period's not over. I'm off to Afghanistan on Thursday, and we can't ever forget that that still remains job one. But we're going into a different period. And as we make that transition, we want to preserve what we've worked so hard to achieve in the last decade. Our new strategy also has to do with protecting and prioritizing key investments in technology and in new capabilities. President Obama insisted that we go out of our way to protect our newest investments in this time of change, because these kinds of investments tend to have the shallowest roots and are therefore the most susceptible to being bureaucratically uprooted. Because these investments are so important to keeping the technological edge upon which so much of our national security depends, the President wanted to ensure that we didn't eat our seed corn in the process of reducing our budget. So in this regard, we're continuing, even in our current budgetary environment, to grow our special operations forces. We're increasing our investments in cyber, in recognition of the growing threat that cyber poses to our national security and our critical infrastructure. And we're concentrating also on our space and our counterspace capabilities. We're protecting our programs to counter weapons of mass destruction. We're investing in intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, including unmanned vehicles. And finally, in regard to new capabilities, we're increasing our investments in certain areas of our science and technology portfolio, such as electronic warfare, anti-jamming capabilities, command, control, and communications, and new and surprising things. A third tenet of our new defense strategy concerns our rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region. Our rebalance, to be clear, is predominantly a political and economic concept, not a military one. But I'm the Deputy Secretary of Defense, so naturally I'm going to concentrate on its security aspects. And in the security sphere, the logic of our rebalance is very simple. The Asia-Pacific region has enjoyed peace and stability for 60 years. A noteworthy exception to this general proposition, and a very dangerous one at that, is of course North Korea. And we are responding to North Korea's threats. We're doing it by defending ourselves and our allies. We're taking a firm but measured approach. But North Korea is really an exception in terms of imminent nation-state aggression in the Asia-Pacific region. The climate of peace and stability in the Asia-Pacific region has prevailed for 60 years, and it's done so long, for so long, despite the fact that there's been no overarching security framework in the region, no NATO, to make sure that the historical wounds, which were and are deep in Asia, were healed after World War II. And during those decades, first Japan rose and prospered, and then South Korea rose and prospered, and then parts of Southeast Asia rose and prospered. And today, India, and yes, in a different way, China rise and prosper. And all of this has been welcomed by the United States. But none of this was a foregone conclusion when you consider where Asia was at the end of World War II. And while the Asian political and economic miracle was realized first and foremost by the hard work and talent of the Asian people themselves, it was enabled by the enduring principles that the United States has stood for in the region, and also by the pivotal role of American military power. Those principles have included a commitment to free and open commerce, a just international order that emphasizes rights and responsibilities of nations, and fidelity to the rule of law, civilian control of the military, open access by all to the shared domains of sea, air, space, and now cyberspace, and the principle of resolving conflict without the use of force. In addition to these principles, it was also enabled by the pivotal role of U.S. military power and presence in the region. And we believe that our strong security presence in the Asia Pacific has provided a critical foundation for our principles to take root. And in one sentence, our rebalance says we're going to continue to provide this foundation for decades to come. Our partners in the region welcome our leadership and the values that underlie them. And therefore, I believe that our rebalance will be welcomed and reciprocated. It's good for us, and it's good for everyone in the region. And it includes everyone in the region. And by the way, it's not aimed at anyone in the region. No individual country or group of countries. The rebalance is reflected in our force structure decisions that we have made and are making, in our presence and our posture, in our investments, not just in technology and new weapon systems, but human capital as well, in innovations in our operational plans and tactics, and perhaps most importantly, in the work we are doing to strengthen our alliances and partnerships in the region. When I discuss the rebalance, I'm usually asked two questions. The first is, can you do it? Can you do it with the budgetary challenges you face? And the answer to this question is yes, we can do the rebalance, and here's why. First, as I mentioned earlier, we're shifting that huge weight that we have applied to Iraq and Afghanistan to the Asia-Pacific region. And second, is that within our budget, which is still substantial, we're making investments in this region a priority. In addition to the current weight of our own defense spending, you also have to take into account that it has accumulated over time. It takes decades to build a military capability like ours. It's also true that in addition to having substantial resources, our force has substantial operational experience, which no other military can match. So for all these reasons, we can do it. Second question I get is, isn't our rebalance really about China? And the answer is no, our rebalance is not about China. It's not aimed at anyone, any individual country or group of countries. It's about ensuring that the peace and stability that the Asia-Pacific has enjoyed for 60 years continues. So that's the first current we face, a great strategic transition as the era of Iraq and Afghanistan comes to an end. And this coincides with the second current, which is the need to absorb some reductions in defense spending in the interest of the nation's overall fiscal situation. Those two great historical currents are coming together. And my view is that they can, if managed properly, reinforce one another. And that is the task before us in the Department of Defense. In terms of our responsibility to the American taxpayer, we know that in making this strategic transition, we only deserve the amount of money we need and not the amount we've gotten used to. That's why, well before the current budget turmoil, we made reductions to the department's budget by $487 billion over the coming decade. This half-trillion-dollar adjustment came on top of significant adjustments that Secretary Gates made during his tenure to eliminate unneeded or underperforming programs. At the same time, our overseas contingency operations funding, which is not included in the base budget, and which is for Iraq and Afghanistan, otherwise known as wartime supplemental funding, is also decreasing now that we have exited Iraq and are drawing down our forces in Afghanistan. Taken together, these reductions compare in pace and magnitude to historical cycles in defense spending the nation has experienced in the past, after Vietnam and after the Cold War. In order to execute the President's defense strategy and responsibly prepare for reductions in defense spending, we need to continue a relentless effort to make every defense dollar count. As Sean stated so eloquently, we began this effort in acquisition, at least, when I was Under Secretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics under the title Better Buying Power, that continues under Frank Kendall. Extended from acquisition throughout the entire department, this means making hard choices and persuading our own bureaucracy and ultimately Congress to support even the very hardest of them, whether they be changes in health care, compensation, basing and other infrastructure, IT consolidation, or headquarters or other staff functions. Making better use of taxpayer dollars is important not only in its own right, since every dollar that's wasted could be used for the nation's defense, but it's also important to win the taxpayers' confidence that they are getting full value for their defense dollar. This is a confidence we must earn to get the public and Congress to support our budget. In a normal budgetary environment, an efficiencies and strategy-driven approach, such as I've described, would be sufficient to meet our defense's needs. But this budgetary environment is anything but normal, particularly because we're operating under sequester. And frankly, none of us, myself included, thought we'd be where we are today. It's worth remembering what we all, lawmakers and senior administration officials, said when sequestration was first proposed as the alternative in case the so-called super committee failed in the 2011 Budget Control Act. And I don't want to hurt any feelings, so I'm not going to name any names, but these quotes come from, I'll start with Congress, both sides of the aisle. Quote, "This would be devastating to defense. This is never going to happen." End quote. Quote, the dumbest idea in a body known for dumb ideas. End quote. Quote, most of us will move heaven and earth to find an alternative that prevents a sequester from happening. End quote. Quote, the sequester is ugly. Why? Because we don't want anybody to go there. End quote. Now, for senior administration officials, here's what we said. Quote, it will not happen. End quote. Quote, the hope is that sequester won't happen. End quote. Quote, I used to be hopeful and optimistic, and now I'm just hopeful. End quote. Now, I will name one name. That last quote was from yours truly, February 2nd. And I meant what I said. The effects of sequestration were and are so damaging that at one point I was optimistic they would not come to pass. Yet here we are. Place never ceases to amaze me. As Yogi Berra used to say, you can observe a lot just by watching. Sequester is not only regrettable in its own right, but it distracts from the true strategic and managerial tasks before us. You might ask, why does this turbulence hit so hard, so fast? Why does an 8% sequester budget cut lead to a crisis in readiness, as the Joint Chiefs of Staff have so aptly called it? To understand this requires some explanation. Sequestration commenced on March 1st and will reduce DOD spending for FY13 by $37 billion. About $20 billion of that $37 billion affects our operation and maintenance accounts, the accounts that most influence day-to-day military readiness. But it gets worse for O&M. The wartime, or OCO, budget is subject also to sequestration, but we can't sequester it. We have to protect our troops at war. That's a must. And what that means is we have to impose extra cuts on the base budget portion of O&M. Worse yet, 2 years ago, when we were estimating the costs of those wartime operations, what wartime operations would cost this year, we estimated low. Due to higher than expected op tempo and transportation costs. So now we have to make further cuts in base budget O&M in order to sustain wartime operations. The bottom line, cuts in the base budget portion of O&M will be more than 20% compared to our request. And we have only 6 months to accommodate most of those cuts. So much for the 8% sequester. When we concluded last January that sequester might actually happen, we began taking actions like imposing hiring freezes, cuts in travel and conferences, reductions in facilities maintenance, and much more. And now that its sequestration is in effect, we're preparing a reprogramming request to move money from other accounts into O&M. But unfortunately, all this isn't going to be enough. We've also had to make large cuts in training and maintenance, which in turn are seriously harming readiness. Let me start with the Army. Among numerous training-related actions, the Army is planning to cancel at least 6 remaining combat center training sessions for its brigade combat teams. This means that we'll be less ready for contingency operations, and it may interfere with our ability to replace units in Afghanistan next year. Serious business. The Air Force has or will soon stop flying for 12 combat-coded squadrons, which means that about one-third of its active squadrons will be markedly less ready to meet contingency demands. The Navy and Marine Corps are also cutting back on flight operations and fleet operations. The Navy has imposed flying restrictions on some non-deployed carrier air wings, and as you've seen, we're not sending ships to sea as we had planned because we don't have the money. Finally, we may have to consider furloughing many of our civilian employees in order to hold down operating costs. Secretary Hagel has not made a final decision on furloughs, but if we have to impose them, they will harm morale and productivity throughout most of our support functions, and this will in turn further damage readiness. What's tragic in all this damage to readiness and national security is that it's not the result of economic emergency or a recession or a depression. It's not because defense cuts are the answer to the nation's long-term fiscal challenge. Do the math. It's not in reaction to a sudden transformation to a more peaceful world. It's not due to a breakthrough in military technology or some new strategic thought. It's not because paths of revenue growth and entitlement spending have been explored and exhausted. It's purely collateral damage of political gridlock. The sequester for fiscal 2013 ends October 1st, but there's no way to know for sure what's next in Washington. We can adjust and adapt to a wide range of contingencies, but this will be easiest if we have stability, time, and flexibility. The President has submitted a budget that meets these goals. The President's budget reflects his overall approach to deficit reduction. For defense, it contains $150 billion more in 10-year cuts compared to last year's plan, in addition to the $487 billion reflected in the Department of Defense's fiscal year 2013 budget. But most of these cuts occur beyond FY18, which gives us time to plan and adjust. While no agency wants to cut its budget, the President's plan is much more acceptable than the cuts that could occur under the Budget Control Act. Cuts that could amount to $52 billion in FY14 alone and could total $500 billion over the next 10 years. We urgently need an agreement to grant us stability, time, and flexibility. The House budget resolution, the Senate budget resolution, and of course the Budget Control Act all confront us with a wide range of future scenarios for our budget. Most immediately, as I said, we need reprogramming relief from Congress for fiscal year 2013 in order to shift money to meet our highest priorities. This reprogramming will deal with a war cost problem, but it doesn't address sequester. In the long term, we simply must have Congress's support to have the flexibility to make budget cuts where they are most in the interest of national defense. Last year, Congress denied proposals ranging from healthcare efficiencies to force structure and modernization proposals that our leadership had proposed and justified. Ideally, we will have all three elements, stability, time, and flexibility with which to make critical budget decisions. But we must anticipate a wide range of possible contingencies. And in that regard, Secretary Hagel asked me to direct a strategic choices and management review, working with our chairman, Artie Dempsey, to define the major strategic choices and institutional challenges affecting the defense posture in the decade ahead that must be made to preserve and adapt our defense strategy under a wide range of future circumstances that could result either from a comprehensive deficit reduction deal or the persistence of the cuts that began with this year's sequester. Everything will be on the table during this review: roles and missions, planning, business practices, force structure, personnel and compensation, acquisition and modernization investments, and how we operate and how we measure and maintain readiness. We plan to complete our work and provide decision points and recommendations to Secretary Hagel in the coming weeks. And the choices that the Secretary and the President make in response to these points in the following months. We'll then inform our FY15 budget submission as well as our FY14 execution decisions. The overarching theme behind our review is that we will need to make tough choices in the years to come, choices that will have significant impacts on the United States, particularly if sequester's effects remain in force. These tough choices, by necessity, must favor national interest over parochial priorities. What we cannot afford, as President Eisenhower said, is a debate in which people are in favor of sequester, but just not in their own backyard. You wouldn't believe the mail I get these days asking to spare this or that sacred cow. Lindsey Graham exposed this as hypocrisy when he said, when it's somebody else's base and district, it's good government. When it's your state or backyard, it's devastating. I couldn't agree more. Fiscal NIMBYism is exactly the wrong policy prescription for what ails us. It's the opposite of the balanced, strategic, and long-term view of which Eisenhower spoke. So as we face this reality together, we will need your help and you will need ours. No one knows better than you, your business, and the effects our fiscal and political challenges are having on our industry. As we grapple with these challenges, the more we're able to align with one another, industry and government, the better we'll be. And we're committed to doing that, and there are a number of ways that we are doing that. One of them I'll just highlight is export, building our exports, and in that connection, we made an important move in the last couple of weeks in the Middle East with respect to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and I hope we're able to do more in that area in the future. So these are the principles upon which we're operating as we turn this strategic corner, and we're trying to make sure that the health of our industry is protected as well. And I look forward to working with you all in that regard. And once again, I want to thank you and your companies, your employees, and your families for what you do for us. I'm honored to accept this year's Eisenhower Award as a symbol of the critical partnership between the United States' armed forces and the defense industrial base. We in the Defense Department are prepared to make difficult strategic and budgetary choices and recognize that you're facing many of the same. We're also committed to finding new ways to improve the way we do business and obtaining greater efficiency and productivity in how we operate. We're committed to the great strategic transition upon which we have embarked. And above all, we're committed to serving our troops who serve us. Each and every day, they risk their lives to keep our nation safe. Stephanie and I frequently visit with them here, abroad, and here and in the hospitals, and every base, post, and installation here. Next week, I'll have the opportunity to visit our troops in Afghanistan and thank them for all they do to continue to defend our freedom. Their work, ultimately, is what we're all here to support. So thank you for partnering with us through what I know are turbulent times. Please extend my thanks to your employees who demonstrate their skill and their patriotism for us every day. We don't take it for granted. We depend on you. And together, we expect to meet the challenges ahead. Thank you.